Buddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. Another observance day. This is a tradition that comes to us from Thailand, from the Tudong tradition. The Tudong tradition is a tradition of asceticism that exists in the fourth monasteries of Thailand. And we are a far cry from the fourth monasteries of Thailand. The tradition in Wat Bapong Ajahn Chah's monastery and other monasteries was to every fortnight on the one pra, as they call it, the observance days, the lay people would come in the evening. In the mornings there'd be a big pindapad, lots of food would be offered, and many people would come and take the precepts. And then the lay people would meditate all day in the monastery. And then in the evening, there'd be the Deshanas, and then it would be sitting through till usually 3 in the morning. And at 3 in the morning, there'd be morning chanting. And then after the morning chanting, we'd prepare our bowls and so on and go for alms round. So it's for the full night. We'd come back after the alms round, and the food would be distributed and you could have the meal. That would finish around 8 or 8:30 in the morning. So it was a long session. In a warm climate, it was really very nice, actually. Hot climate, at night time is a nice time to practice. Fewer mosquitoes, cooler. Walking meditation outside in the full moon was really lovely. But it took a lot of endurance. One really had to endure a lot of negative states of mind. And of course, the logical mind is saying, well, it's stupid, I should go to sleep, and then I could really meditate better, and I could get better samadhi, and this is, so certainly this must be self-mortification, this is the middle path. And look at these monks, they're all falling asleep anyway, and what's the use of this, and I want to go to sleep. And this is what the mind would do. But endurance is something that is kind of very much stressed and is stressed in the fourth tradition. And it is a quality which is paramount in the religious life, because if we cannot forbear the negative things, physical, mental, emotional, social, that we inevitably will come across, if we cannot forbear and we continually move towards that which is comfortable, safe and secure, that need to move will always deny us the stillness of the mind. That need to find security, comfort, warmth in another condition, in another person, in another situation, is a kind of restlessness which will prevent it from realizing deep peace. I've just been reading a very interesting book called Forest Recollections by a Thai woman, a PhD from Stanford. And this is about the forest monks in the northern tradition of Thailand. Ajahn Mun, who died in 1950, he was the granddaddy of the forest tradition, an awesome character, formidable endurance and strength and samadhi, who attracted monks from all over Thailand, monks who were seeking out a good master. And he was very elusive. They'd always be looking for him and not find him. He would just take off. So if you see me gone tomorrow. and he was very, 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 he really pushed his monks. And just reading the accounts of what their practice was actually to seek out danger and discomfort. in the north of Thailand, northeast of Thailand, the forests are still intact, full of elephants, tigers, snakes, the whole ecological chain was intact. And today I was just reading about Ajahn Chah, who died about 2 years ago, the famous monk from Nongkhai, I think. And when he was a young monk, these monks would go wandering into the Shan states, into Burma, into Cambodia, through northern Thailand, northeast Thailand. And this was before Thailand was really opened up to roads. So it was very, very wild, there were very few roads, there were no maps. The monks basically didn't know where they were going. They could roughly know what direction. And they really didn't care where they were going, because it was the going that was important. It was not the final destination. They might be seeking teachers. But basically they were challenging themselves, putting themselves in terribly difficult situations. Things which I don't know if I could handle. Very, very often kind of practices. But the Ajahn Chah, this I just read, he had three principles if anybody wanted to go with him on Tudong. One was no grumbling. You weren't allowed to grumble about the accommodation, which was basically a mosquito net and a forest. And you weren't allowed to grumble about the food, which was often non-existent. Because they'd be traveling in places like the Shan states where people didn't quite know what a monk was. Or they would lose a track in a forest and then not be able to find a village for a couple of days. So they were really up against very, very, physically very, very difficult and challenging. No medicine, no food, often tigers. So in this little bit, Ajahn Chah just gashed his leg very deeply. And there's no village around. They lose their way on the trail. They're walking at night. Finally, at 3 a.m., they decide they're just exhausted. And they try to go to sleep. And they're on the ridge of a mountain. There's a wind blowing. They can't put up their mosquito net. And so they find a kind of grassy place and try to lay down. And the striking bit is he binds his wound up so it doesn't bleed to death. And then, because they're sweating and there's a lot of blood, it attracts hordes of ants and termites. And he had to wrap cloth around his head so that the ants wouldn't drink the tears from his eyes. Formidable character. So it puts my whinging into perspective. You can play violence. But what often these monks were brought to a state of despair, a state of crying. And Ajahn Chah talks about one of those where, I think it was the one in the charnel ground, where he faces some very, very terror-ridden states of mind, and faces those, and then it's raining, and he's wet, and he's all alone, and what the heck am I doing here? And he starts crying because the despair comes up in him. These monks were taking on the most difficult kind of human conditions, like insecurity, lack of food, lack of medicine, lack of home surroundings. Of course, what were noticed about them is the fearlessness of these teachers, such as Chan, the Mahabhu and people like that. The way they manifested the teaching was different. Some were fierce, some were very gentle. Ajahn Fun, which matched him very well. He was very fun, he was a very kind of gentle teacher. But they all had this kind of fearlessness. So that's kind of one model. You see, but there are no more forests in Thailand now. In 40, 50 years they've wiped it all out. The tigers are gone, the elephants are gone. And the monasteries are pretty much secure and settled. But there are other models, and say one of the things on these all-night sittings that we had in Thailand, some of the most impressive people were the village women, where these would be women who you know, they usually be over 50, who had spent their lives working very, very hard in the field and raising families. And they would come, practice all day, they cook the meals for the monks on these observance days, and then they'd sit up. And some of them just would not budge, which was really inspiring for me, because I was definitely budging, shifting, and you know, the mosquitoes biting me. Some of these women were very, very impressive, very impressive. And the kind of joy in their being and the morality that they lived by. And they had a completely different practice. It was the practice of stability. It wasn't a practice of wandering. It was the practice of staying put, taking responsibility, doing the same thing day in and day out, day in and day out. So that doesn't sound very maybe adventurous. It doesn't sound as exciting or interesting maybe as facing down a tiger. But one sensed in these people also a fearlessness and a peacefulness about them, because they had, in some sense, I guess they had honored their karma, their situation, and learned from that. Other kind of models you have, like the Paprayut, who is the monk that, you know that book, the Samasati, right, mindfulness, and Good, Evil, and Beyond, is that the one on karma? This is a very famous Thai monk in Bangkok. He's a whole different role model, where he was, he's about 60 now. When he was a novice, he ordained at 11 or so. And when he was in Thailand, they have a system of study in the cities where they have 9 levels, 9th being the highest level, of both in Pali, in the language, and in Dhamma. And this is very, you know, this is like a triple PhD kind of thing. And very few people attain to the highest. Well, Paprayut attained both 9th level as the Samanera in both things, which was an incredible rarity. And then the king was his sponsor for his ordination. And he's got a kind of encyclopedic mind. Now his practice is completely different. He stayed in Bangkok, and he lived in that whole ecclesiastical hierarchy, and lives in that, and writes. That's his name. Studies and writes, and tries to serve society by trying to point out the right way for society, morally, ethically, socially. He's lectured in Harvard for a year. He won a UNESCO education, Peace Education Prize, which he got about 10 years ago, I think. And he's the only Thai and only monk who's ever received that. Very prestigious. There's a whole different model. And of course, it's good to him also. And it's very lovely being a very refined, most refined kind of man I think I've ever met. Very genteel. Very aesthetic, actually. Very simple. He's very simple. He just has 3 robes, washes them at night, puts them on again in the morning. And it's actually dedicated to his work, his kind of incredible stamina for his kind of intellectual work, which is really hard. Then you have a model like Tanjakun Panyananda, you know, who's been here. He decided to set up a monastery outside Bangkok, which is now in the middle of Bangkok. He serves society through teaching on television, on the weekends in his monastery, gets 1,000 people to listen to his talk. You think Amaravati's crowded. That place is just packed with people. Some doctors came to him some years ago saying that they wanted to build a hospital, and they had to do some fundraising. And so they asked him to be the name on the fundraising. And I think they've built a 10-story hospital now next to his monastery. So he was willing to be the front man for that, and people come and just offer him money. He's just sitting there, people come offer money for the hospital, which is a different kind of practice, which is kind of bodhisattva, self-sacrifice practice. Ajahn Buddhadasa, the sort of forest monk who's very, studied a lot and gave himself to his writings and building monasteries. You have all these different kinds of models. The models for women, I don't know lives, because in Thailand the opportunities for women to practice in monasteries are not so great. There are a few that exist, but the models for the women were more the ones I saw, and I can only speak of what I saw, were that there was this kind of sense of practice of stability. And somehow I relate to that a lot, to be truthful, because I don't go chasing tigers. So I relate to the old ladies that chewed betel nuts and just stayed. They're always there, they're always there. And stability is also a kind of important thing to consider. So although we come from like a Tudong tradition, a wandering tradition, actually we are a monastic tradition. We're not a wandering tradition, it's ancient. I mean, how many of us actually get to wander? So if you go to Thailand, maybe you can do that. But actually, I think what we're practicing is more stability, which is a kind of Christian model. And it's also, I mean, it's a Buddhist model too, but it's a traditional Christian monastery, at least from what I've seen. This idea of stability is very important, where, say, like the sister or mother Rosemary, who comes here sometimes, she lives in a monastery in Oxford. I think they have a few acres of land, and basically they can't leave. That's it. They leave. They can leave, what, 2 weeks a year, I think. And they come and do a retreat here. And they just have like 20 women, and they're just there. And men have also that, just there. The same people, day in and day out, day in and day out, day in and day out. And the practice of stability also has great power, I think. Because I think all of it is somehow challenging the desire mind somewhere. And inevitably, when we live in a place for a period of time, we don't want to be in the place we're with or the people we're with. We want to be with someone else, someplace else. We meet some character that rubs us up the wrong way. We get totally, totally, utterly bored with the same chanting again, again, whatever. And so that's a challenge, is to stay put and observe the way things are without the judgment. You know, without thinking it should be different, or just kind of observing the suffering that takes place in our own hearts and minds. And this is, of course, the kind of more kind of the model that we have in this kind of a place, this kind of a situation where we have a routine, we have the people that are here. And I think community life, to develop wholesomely, a group of people to really develop community has to live together. And community is about living together, it's not all about wandering off. And I think all of us who have been here for a few years, I think we've kind of scraped a few rough edges off each other by just being with each other and observing ourselves as how we react and maybe becoming a bit much, much less judgmental, much kinder. The models from the Tudong tradition in Thailand could be very, very harsh. But I did find, say, the monks are actually quite gentle. So although the teaching seemed like very tough, and one of the basic teachers of Wotton, which is endure, Wotton, this is a very heavy word always in the Thai, forcing Wotton, Wotton, if I hear that again, you know, endure, endure, it's your karma, endure, endure, it's your karma, this is the kind of refrain you got quite often. And yet I found with the Thai monks that they knew how to work with much more joy than I did. They knew how to relate with each other in a much more kind of gentle and soft way than I did. And so for myself, I found that I had a kind of water buffalo endurance sometimes, that I could, you know, I could endure a lot, but I found for myself that really I needed much more teachings around gentleness, because will I had lots of willpower. I could do kind of force practices that were demanded of me, but I had to, personally, I had to balance willpower with a more kind of gentle, opening, receptive attitude than willful attitude. Anyway, each one of us is going to find, we're going to have different things that we need to work with. So whatever situation you're in, whether you're in Amaravati or you're Fortismos in Thailand, to take responsibility for what you're feeling and to not just seek comfort. I think that's important, isn't it? Because I think what would destroy the holy life is luxury and comfort. Just, you know, seeking a lifestyle where one's emotions are somehow always feeling secure and happy. Being with people where you feel nurtured all the time is nice. But sometimes that weakens someone. It can be very weakening at times. It can be enriching, it can be nourishing, it can be, you know, it can help you. But also the times where one feels anxiety and fear and despair and these kinds of things are very strengthening if one is willing to look at them as Dhamma. Because in the entering into those areas of pain and etc., one has to endure. One has to endure with what sometimes seems unendurable. And in that, being able to observe and witness to that which it seems I can't take this anymore, the heart begins to gain a lot of strength. If one can sit through despair and loneliness and fear, and really be with that for whatever while it demands to be there, then the strength that comes is a kind of fearlessness, because one is no longer afraid of those emotions. One is willing to be in even the most dark kind of situation. So please don't think that if you face difficulties like that, that there's anything wrong with you or the monastery. If situations are immoral, then there's something wrong and we need to say. But if situations bring up, you know, feelings of anxiety, irritation, boredom, then that discomfort is tremendously important. It is really the key. Because in discomfort and agitation and in unhappiness and in dukkha, there is that need to move away from it, to blame it, to do something about it. And the centeredness of knowing, the ability to be stable in that and just staying and observing, is something that then transcends the very difficulties of despair, fear, loneliness. Not through running away, but either through witnessing to it as Dharma. And what we try to do is we try to set up an intellectual system which gives us the right attitude, the right view, the right understanding in our observation. And if one begins to say, observe something negative and positive in the mind, and one really contemplates how it changes. So if you can sit through something like both inspiration and boredom, or to sit through despair and or like feelings of being hurt and rejected, those kinds of feelings, and you can also observe feelings of being nurtured and cared for, if you can observe that polarity and you see that both of them are worldly, they come and they go, they're changing, you can't hang on to them, then what you begin to realize is the signless. Because in the contemplation of impermanence, one sees that there's nothing you can latch on to. And there is the sense of the signless, which is that knowing of change, which is signless. If we really observe, we're willing to observe the dukkha of any situation, and this is where stability is very good, that in any monastery, say Amaravati or whatever, you begin to see how sometimes it's harmonious and sometimes it's just a shlemaza. And how sometimes, you know, everyone's getting along and sometimes people are stabbing themselves, each other in the back. And you know, you keep watching that. And this is stability. You keep observing that in the monastery, in your own mind. And you see how really it's all dukkha in that way. It really is unsatisfactory. You begin to touch desirelessness. Because desirelessness is realizing that any movement on desire can never fully satisfy, can never fully fulfill. And there's the realization of desirelessness, which is the knowing of Dhamma. And the more you watch the knee and mind, the more we observe the sense of me and mine and really just see it as a construct. We just see it as a phenomena, and we see that it's movement and the creation of time and the creation of becoming and the creation of personal history and the creation of alienation and separation and all that me and mine does to us. And we keep observing that, and it's to see that actually it's not a fixed thing, it's a movement, it's an object, it's a conditioned phenomena. We begin to realize emptiness, the spaciousness and emptiness of not-self, the mind which is not preoccupied, self-obsessed with the mind. And this is one way of talking about what our realization can be: signlessness, desirelessness, emptiness, anicca, dukkha, anatta, through the contemplation of whatever you're experiencing. And this, and the practice of stability is very good that way. You know, when you're just in a situation and you're not, you know, we're not manipulating it to get what we want, and we're not doing anything from that, you know, we're not trying to create our own little comfortable mess, then inevitably we're faced with things. We have to look at things. We have to be with people in situations which, you know, are not according to our own design. Not something that I want. And then if we have a sense of stability, we learn how to endure these things. In that sense of endurance, there's a kind of confidence and fearlessness and peacefulness, which is not a construct of desire. It's not a function of desire, but it's a function of insight. It's a function, it's like a barometer, you know, the kind of development of virtuous qualities which are the foundation of a peaceful mind. Say, like in Thailand, I suffered tremendous feelings of loneliness. And I'd be sent off to some monastery where no one could speak English, and I found the abbot utterly uninspiring. And I would be playing in my mind about him, and there'd be no tea or coffee, and there'd be five of us, and the same five people for 10 months, and the same meal most of the 10 months: sticky rice, chili, and a bit of rotten fish. You know, this is kind of the same thing day in and day out, and it wasn't facing tigers. Wasn't a tiger inside, the only thing was mosquitoes. And the kind of tremendous loneliness that would come up there. Just, you know, just, I once went back to Wat Pho Phong, and I met Ajahn Khema Thunlo. He was the first Westerner I could find, and I talked at him for 4 hours. It was just this catharsis of verbal diarrhea, which the poor man had to endure, and kindly endured. But now, what's the point of that? What's the point of just sitting in a kind of isolated corner of Thailand and just being lonely? Is that, you know, that it seems like self-mortification, doesn't it? But actually what I found was being able to feel those things, then what happened is the need for whatever, you know, the need for companionship or the need for my own culture, that which was just one of the ways that desire and need is functioning or manifesting, that need began to cease. That desire began to cease, not through me getting rid of it, but rather me being trapped with it and having to witness to it. In a way, the only thing I could have done was to run away. So that entrapment. And again, stability was important. Because if I would have felt that loneliness on a little weekend retreat in the Wat Ban Bue in the middle of northern Thailand, big deal. It'd just be a kind of unpleasant event, and I'd never go back there again. Because I don't like that place. I felt lonely. I'd just try to find some place with the nature. Yeah. So what was the value of, you know, spending months of just feeling, you know, just like a gray state of boredom, loneliness and self-doubt and, you know, this kind of mind state? What's the point of that? Well, for me, it was the point of just getting a lot of strength with negative states of mind, being able to endure and bear with, not, you know, a life which wasn't exciting and interesting. And I've always, of course, I found it helpful. Really helpful, that kind of foundation of being in those things. Say also for like for myself, so part of my learning has been just having to teach. And there's been a kind of stability in that, in that I, like when I came to, the reason I came to England originally because Ajahn Chah told me to. I really did not want to come to England. I wanted to stay in Thailand. But I had faith in my teacher, and I was grateful to Ajahn Spinoza. And so that what I found, the practice of stability there, was just being with whatever was given or asked of me. And so what was asked of me, of course, was to teach. And I had to teach a 10-day retreat when I had 3 or 4 rains, which is illegal in our system. And I basically was a shy person, so then I felt a lot of fear. Now if I had just taught one retreat, you know, then I'd say, well, that was a rotten experience, I won't do that again, I was afraid, I'm not meant to be a teacher. Which would be a kind of egotistical way of looking at it. But when I decided, I said, well, if you suffer, you just have to learn about that. And so that became the practice of stability, was just being with that situation time and time and time and time and time again. And then for me, the talk wasn't terribly important. What was more was the fear. So the situation which brought the anxiety was, I realized, very important for my practice. Now, if I had just taken the role, you know, the way of comfort, then, you know, logically I could say, no, it's, you know, I'm not ready. I should go back to Thailand, to the forest of Thailand, and really practice. Or, you know, I'm not an arahant yet. I can't teach. But Ajahn Sumedho said, well, you probably know a little bit more than the people you're looking at. So just say something. But what I'm trying to point to is that I think for insight to arise and for craving to cease, you have to keep going into these situations again and again and again and again. And very few people that I've met can just kind of on a one-off experience fear and then be beyond fear. Or a one-off situation, feel loneliness and be beyond loneliness. It usually takes this confronting of some kind of karmic situation. Classically with people you get that, don't you? In a big situation like this, it's not, you don't feel lonely. The opposite, you just want to be alone. It's a different kind of situation, with a different kind of friction that you might feel. But then that's the practice, isn't it? Like if it's with people, and it's time to be with people, and you feel agitated, then that's the practice. How can I be at peace with a lot of people around? Rather than think, well, my place is too many people, I can't get my samadhi, so I'm getting out of here. That's the same as me coming up and saying, oh no, this isn't good for me because I feel fear. So is the practice good for you, or just feel comfortable? It is, I mean, logically you can see that, isn't it? You just to get what you want. Imagine that the holy life is to get what I want. That'd be a really shallow kind of approach to the holy life. I can't get what I want, therefore I'm going to find a place that really suits me. You know, the right diet, the right people, the right ajahn, and so you kind of do a sort of designer monastery. But is that going to make anyone strong? But they can't, because it's just tenders to desire. Which doesn't mean that we can't leave and go to places where we think the practice will be helpful. It's not saying that. But to always just function from that kind of lack of commitment, you know, being unwilling to die, I don't think there can be much strength myself. When Ajahn Chah asked me, why did you come here? I said, oh, I want to get enlightened, something like that. He said, you came here to die. And he used to say that to everyone, of course. And then, well, okay. And this sense of dying before you die, the sense of, for like, you know, the ego actually dying by being dealing with these really unpleasant things. I think one of the phrases of modern life is I'm keeping my options open. I think that leads to option paralysis, actually. I think that's the kind of weakness of our culture, where this idea that, I don't know, I might get stuck here. I don't know, I don't want to give up on this one. It's just usually not really wanting to die. Wanting kind of safety and comfort. But what renunciation is about is the sense of giving up to something bigger than oneself, more obviously, and then being willing to stay in there, to endure. So the forest monks, they would go out and they would face tigers. That's pretty extreme, there are not many tigers around. But I think the model is the same of just facing whatever life brings us. Just really just being willing to be with the things that are presented to one rather than the constant reorganization of life according to the optimal options of one's own weaknesses. It's a weakening of the human character. And this kind of facing up to things is not just a willfulness. It's not just kind of, because that's what I tried in the beginning. I just tried to use willpower to face up to my defilement. And so I'd fast. And so I would do these 10-day fasts. And I always felt miserable. And Ajahn Anando, he always felt radiant. He always came to come out, no, not this one, Ajahn Anando, the old one. This is Mach 2. But the old one, he always had this kind of radiance and brightness about him, and I always thought my practice was bad. Of course, then I found I had a liver function, which fasting brought me into a jaundiced state, and actually, I should feel bad. But I was just, and then I deny myself sleep. Okay, I'm not going to sleep. I'm really tough. Okay, and then I had a seizure. I didn't sleep. And so I did all kinds of crazy things just through willpower. And that's not really facing up to one's stuff, I should say. That's just trying to use the willpower to become something or to overcome something. And as I was saying yesterday, that is oppressive. When we use willpower just to get something or get rid of something, this holy life is not possible. It becomes an oppression, a tyranny of the will, a tyranny of our own warped idealism, really. Where we think we should be, or what we should be, or how we should be, or whatever, all that. And so there's a defeat in the holy life. Very often. Usually there is a defeat. And that defeat seems to be necessary for most of us. Where the will can no longer win. And where we know wherever we go, we're going to face the same stuff. And we no longer believe in running away, I suppose. Okay. Where our mechanisms of control no longer operate, something comes up where we can't win with the control. And we're faced with life as it is, and we're defeated. And in that defeat, quite often, there's a lot of peace. Okay. Because we give up, we let go. We're forced to let go. And this is the sense of dying before you die. And religious literature is full of that. Full of that. And I think the making effort, and you have these very high teachings of enlightenment and jhanas and blah, 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 blah. And of course, we get very greedy. I think it's especially difficult in modern culture because we can read about the most exalted beings. And we can read about, Teresa of Avila and St. John of the Cross and Xu Yun and Sufi Master Rumi and all these beings. And you read about them and they're so inspiring. And then you read about their experiences and what they're actually, like Teresa of Avila levitating. We were talking about her the other nuns had to pull her down. It was a bit of an embarrassment. Or Ajahn Chah, meet someone like that, the kind of radiance of the man and the power. And then what have I got? Grumbling mind, painful knees, whinging those things, and you think, oh, how pathetic I am and all that. But all of these beings have gone through that. They've all gone through that. Don't think that somehow they've just come into the monastery, watched their nose, and then boing. No, they've all gone through defeat. Because they've all tried to get enlightened. And they've all tried to fight their curiosity. And, you know, from what I've read, they always seem to come to the sense of the dark night of the soul. The sense of defeat and despair. That sounds maybe very gloomy, gloomy kind of talk, but to come to a sense of true trust and true faith and abandonment and relinquishment is awfully difficult because the ego yells and screams. It wants to be. It wants to become. It wants to have power and command. And so the practice of stability, being in a situation, is one where eventually, you know, we are faced with something we can't control, we can't get rid of, we can't manipulate anymore to get what we want, and we have this sense of suffering, be it loneliness or boredom or whatever. And then the challenge is to endure with faith, with good faith, to endure that this will change. And that's the test. Because the desire mind is saying, I've got to do something about this. And the wisdom mind is saying, it will change. And the desire mind is blaming, and the wisdom mind is saying it will change. And through that kind of endurance and stability, then one did see it did change. And what's left is that clear knowing, clear seeing. And once, and quite often we have, you know, once we break through a cycle of loneliness or despair or whatever, then the second time is so much easier, because what we've established is confidence in awareness and knowing Dhamma. And this breaking of karmic pattern often is difficult. It's the stronger a karmic pattern of avoidance, distraction, repression is, then the more difficult it is to allow that to become conscious, because we've been so conditioned to not allow that to become conscious. And that, quite often, that difficulty that we have, or the reason actually that we can do that is because we're trapped. You know, we're trapped in a situation where it's not according to our desires, it's according to something else. And entrapment is stability. The more we move that way, the more we come to the trusting heart. And the trusting heart is a different kind of energy. And the trusting heart is not the energy of will, it's the silence of the will. The trusting heart is more the sense of receiving life and responding from trust and faith, rather than reacting through will, desire, control, manipulation. Different way of operating. It's a way of operating, it's more like waking rather than becoming. So this is foreign. This is foreign to a whole culture of becoming. This is what we come from. We come from a culture of becoming, achieving, getting in it. Our efforts are so much honed by those attitudes, don't they? That's what we're conditioned into. And even though intellectually one might agree with this kind of thing about effort, still emotionally we're bound by our cultural conditioning and our ego conditioning, really, to become and get rid of, and to find the middle way of abandonment, relinquishment, letting go, trust. Faith is a difficult thing. We tend not to be devotional beings, you know. We tend to be more intellectual beings, quite often willful. And like so often devotional practices, people might find, men at least, I don't know, maybe women, but for myself, devotional practices I found more difficult than willful practices. It's kind of easy to be willful. It's easy to do that. But actually that surrender, let go, welcome in, trust, faith, which is the whole bhakti side of religion, that is far more difficult. So, yeah, I'll leave that for tonight.